This is Diane Magris from the Maine Humanities Council, and I'd like to welcome you to another in our series of podcasts exploring the power and pleasure of ideas in Maine.
What a pleasure to be asked to come here tonight and introduce my friend Wesley McNair to you. I decided that since you know all about Wesley's books by just reading the flyers and a lot of the information in the press about him, that I'll tell you a little bit about Wesley the man. I came to the conclusion, having ridden with several American poets over the past 10 years in an automobile, that they should not be given driver's licenses. And I think that the better the poet, the worse the driver. And Wesley McNair is the worst driver I have ever ridden with. I have a character in one of my novels who says to another character, "What is the logic of shooting 15 feet past a stop sign, saying oops and backing up?" I thought that was fiction until I got into an automobile with Wesley McNair. I was in the back seat, another unfortunate soul in the passenger side. I don't even remember who it was. I remember that at one point I lay down in the back seat and shouted, "Oh my God, this is how Albert Camus died." The more Wesley turned around to assure me that everything was fine, thereby not watching the road, the worse it got. Several years after that, Wesley came down to Nashville to read at the Southern Festival of Books, bringing his lovely, delightful wife, Diane, with him. And one of the things I'll always remember about that is that Diane came with a bag of Maine apples through three airports all the way to Nashville to bring me Maine apples. And it wasn't a half a bag. It was a bag exploding with Maine apples. They had to have rolled all over the floor of the plane at one point, I would think. While they were there in Nashville, I had just moved into a new house. And Wesley and Diane came and spent a couple of days over there. And I don't know if Diane remembers this or Wesley, but I certainly do. We were in the kitchen at one point, Wesley, Eliza Clark, a Canadian novelist, and I. And we needed to heat the oven to 350 degrees so we could put some food in it to heat it. And we pushed a lot of buttons. There was a lot of discussion. It didn't seem to really be working. So Wesley said, "Let's put our hands in the oven and wait till it feels like 350 degrees. Believe it or not, we did that. Eliza and I, all three of us, have our hands in the oven. Buttons have been pushed. Sincerity was rampant. A voice behind us said, "What are you doing?" And it was Diane McNair. And we turned around, and it was Diane. And I said, "We've pushed some buttons." And Wesley said, always the forerunner of any group, Wesley, the spokesperson, spoke for us. He said, "We're waiting until it feels like 350 degrees. So Diane reached by us and went click, 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 and then walked away. And Eliza said, "I think the oven's getting warm now." And Wesley said, "I think we should take our hands out of the oven now." In this age of reparations and talk of such, I think that anyone who lives with a poet or a novelist should be given a pension from the government. And it's just possible Diane is our poster girl. When I got ready to come up here yesterday, I kept trying to think of how can I talk about Wesley McNair and his poetry and how much I love it and what it means to me without sounding like one of the Gabor sisters on the Merv Griffin show. So at the last minute, I spilled coffee. My husband's trying to drive me to the airport, and I ran in and I printed out an email that I sent to Wesley after I read Fire. And I'm not going to read any of my favorite lines to his poems, because I saw that happen to Edward Hirsch one time. The introduction, the lady who was giving the introduction, went on for 20 minutes about his best lines in his poems and read them all. And when Hirsch stood up to read, he looked like a balloon with no air left in it. And it was a painful moment. I'm going to read you this email. I hope Wesley doesn't mind that I'm doing this, but You won't remember, but the first time that I came to Farmington and met you, I'd read a collection of your poems beforehand. I said to you, "I have the feeling at times that your people are searching for parts of their bodies in order to become whole, and parts of bodies are searching for their people in order to become whole, or at least to get comfortable with each other." I said it a lot better back then because I really thought hard in those days, but you get the gist. I can't pick out any favorites, and yet I want to. I want to say, oh, this one, This one, that's the one. I love them all. But I can't help but reread An Executive's Afterlife and then The Rules of the New Car, The Visitors. Yes, The Visitors. But what about Charles by Accident or Shovels or The Good Boy Suit? Oh, what about The Sadness of Rooms? Never mind, I can't pick one. Okay, I can. Your poem, Fire, is simply extraordinary. Oh, Wesley, the images, the sorrow of lives, too many stunning images to mention here. All the old wishes, the pains floating out the car window, streaming with the winds. I think back to Allagash, to Mama's weedless gardens, how hard she ironed my dresses after crocheting flowers on the collars, making them by hand, how much she cared what neighbor said this or that, the petty gossips, the goals that now seem so tiny, all that stuff now locked in photographs. That poem, your poems, unlock it all again. Reading your poems hurts me. I think that's why I delayed reading this collection until I was ready. They hurt in that part of my heart that is sealing itself up. People dropping dead, childhood growing dimmer by the day, more of our lives behind us now than ahead of us. What to do but to protect oneself? And yet poems don't let us do that. Poems are little knives. I think what you do best, Wesley, is that you take the big stuff and you make it small for the rest of us so that everyone can understand the great themes of love and hate and life and death. The guy at the 7-Eleven can say, this poem is about me. The girl behind the ticket counter at Delta in her little blue suit knows the hurt. This is such a gift because with the hurt comes a joyous reaffirmation of life. Look, I'm waxing sentimental here, so I'll stop. It's just that reading great poetry changes the day. The light suddenly is slanting in a different way, reminding me of the yellow light of college days when most of life was still ahead. Objects, once silent and behaving themselves, jump out at me after reading a poem. Everything suddenly demands notice. Everything is suddenly important in the wake of poetry. You've changed my days, my tiny world, my whole outlook yet again. And it won't be the last time. I know this, Wesley. You're probably back at it right now, your pen against paper, creating a new one. This book is called Mapping the Heart. If you haven't read this, I flew to Northern Maine 3 weeks ago, and I read it starting in Nashville and finished it when I drove from into the yard in Allagash, sitting in the passenger side reading. It is absolutely wonderful, and I want to read just one little paragraph about Wesley. This is essays and reflections on place in poetry, the prose. And I'll end with this and let you hear Wesley's poetry. This is Wesley talking about his childhood. 2 or 3 years ago, I became acquainted with an aging couple I met as a child in the first New England place I can remember, a project called Southview outside of Springfield, Vermont, where I lived with my impoverished, angry mother and my two brothers after my father left. Today, I receive a videotape of the couple's 50th anniversary celebration and play it on my VCR. Now and again, on the tape, among the people who chat over cocktails or gather at the salad bar to show off their children, I recognize the two of them. Then I find each of their daughters, my old playmates, now parents themselves. But the person I am most interested in is the one who appears in a slide presentation of the couple's years in Southview. Myself, as a child of 7 or 8, sitting outside their apartment on a cold day with my younger brother and their three girls. The daughter who runs the slideshow points me out to the audience. This boy grew up to be a poet, she says. There is a hum. Looking at him, the jacketless kid with a hole in his t-shirt, I also feel disbelief. And then, for the longest time, pleasure. Ladies and gentlemen, the poet Wesley McNair.
Well, thank you all for being here. Thank you, John Cole. And I want to thank especially a person who I think single-handedly put this event together. I'm speaking of Susan DeWitt Wilder. Thanks an awful lot, Susan, for all the thankless work you have done. And, of course, thank you, Kathy. That introduction was so funny. was so witty, was so interesting, was so moving, I have to say. I think we should quit right now. But I do want to say, Kathy, that any bouquet that you might extend to me as a writer, I could match with a bouquet of my own for you. As a matter of fact, I want to begin this reading with a poem of thanks to Kathy. It's a poem that, I don't know if you remember this, Kathy, but years ago I sent you a batch of poems to see which ones you might like, and you picked this one out. You liked it especially. So this poem is for you. It's called The One Who Will Save You. And it has to do with walking in the wilds of West Central Maine and coming suddenly upon a particular kind of dog and country house and country family. The One Who Will Save You. If some afternoon you should pass by there and the woman comes out swooping her blue bathrobe back from her bath and crying, "Baby, oh my sweet baby," it won't be you, she means. Nor you, the hubby wearing motorcycles on his t-shirt and jumping down from the stairless sliding glass door, says he wants to kill, so just stand still. It's the dog they'll be after, the shadow under the not-quite-sunk pink Chevy, ratcheting itself up with a slow, almost inaudible growl into the biggest, ugliest Shepherd Labrador Husky cross West Central Maine has ever seen. It won't matter if the two shirtless fat kids come from around back with hubcaps on their heads and shout even louder than their father does, "Queenie!" By then, Queenie, less a queen than a chainsaw, lunging at the potential cordwood of your legs, won't know or care what humans have named her. There'll be no hope for you, pal, unless that is the teenage daughter who comes across the front lawn's dandelions in her tank top every so often to set me free, releases you too, shaking her head as if only you and she could see how impossible her stupid parents and this uncool dog really are, and lifting it like that by the collar to create a bug-eyed sausage that gasps so loud her mother gasps, not that the daughter will care, mother, she'll say, eyeing the sorry choice of afternoon attire. You should see how you look. Then flicking dad out of the way and renaming the creature she's created Peckerwood. She'll march as if she herself were now queen back through that kingdom of California raisins and tires and Christmas lights decking the front porch in July and past the screen door with a sign saying, "This is not a door," to disappear rump by rump with a bump and a grind to you through the real screen door. So that's the way it is in West Central Maine. I just forget. For goodness sake, be careful if you ever go there. You would think hearing that poem that I didn't care much about dogs, and that would not be true. So I want to read you a poem from Fire. I should point out that many of the poems, if not most of the poems I'll read tonight, will come from this new book, Fire, though I've pulled some other poems in around the edges from other books. This is a poem about a beloved dog that my wife, Diane, and I got when he was half-grown at the pound. I don't know if you've ever done that, gotten a half-grown dog at the pound, but if you have, you'll know you're in for some surprises. This poem is titled Charles by Accident. And Victoria, I hope you're listening. Charles by accident. Named Charlie, for the relaxed companionship we expected, he became Charles for his butler-like obedience. Though he went off duty the morning my wife walked back from the mailbox, watching him toss what looked like a red sock gloriously into the air, seeing it was actually the cardinal she had been feeding all winter. Why did she scream like that? Was the question his whole horrified body seemed to ask just before he disappeared. Back soon at the door, black coat white collar, all ready to serve us. Who was that other dog anyway? Who, on the other hand, was this one, chosen at the pound for his breed and small size, now grown into three or four different kinds of large dogs stuck together? It wasn't his fault, of course, that in the end he wasn't Charlie, or even, considering the way he barked at guests and sniffed them, Charles, exactly. Besides, it couldn't have been easy to be whatever sort of dog he was. Part retriever, he spent his winters biting ice and summer's dirt out of his tufted paws. Part collie, all he ever got to herd were two faux sheep, a wire-haired terrier that bit him back, and a cat that turned and ran up trees. An accidental sheepdog, Charles, by accident, and our dog, only after he'd been disowned, he understood that life is all missed connections and plan B. The reason why, perhaps, no one could quite pat him or say good boy enough, or why, sometimes, asleep, he mourned, working his legs, as if running to a place he could never reach, beyond Charles, or any other way we could think of to call him. Well, I have this feeling that if you're going to be a Maine poet, you have to have at least one poem about trucks, with trucks in it. And also, I'm not talking about those little pickup trucks, though Lord knows there are plenty of those around Maine, but I'm talking about those great big semis that we see passing by us on the primary and secondary roads of Maine. This poem is a kind of homage to those trucks, and it's called What They Are. Not the four wheels, but clusters of four and six wheels spinning into steel hollows far below the cab. Not a cab, but high dark windows under a crown of lights and a vast grill displaying its name. Papa Bear, Snowman, Silver Eagle. Not a truck, but a bird lifting up over the hill outside Rumford with a long straight tail of logs. Or in the north woods, a ship drifting down, its tarp swelling in the rain and wind. Not a ship, but a starship landing on the night streets of Presque Isle, lights in the doors and all along the roof. Not a roof, but a bed for lime from Thomaston, or a cement mixer slowly turning, or a sleek vessel for milk from Kennebec Valley Farms. Not one, not once, but many, day after day, passing above us like great Buddhas with headlights in their knees and small hands resting at their windshields on roads all over Maine. Susan Wilder said I should read you that poem tonight from Fire because the state, it turns out, is going to put this poem on a scenic view turnout. This is the truth. Actually, there's going to be another one, too, above Solon, believe it or not. But this one will be near the top of a long hill that leads toward Rangeley. I guess the idea is that, you know, if you should get stuck behind one of these big semis on that hill, you can always pull off and try to let the poem assuage you. But never mind. Here's an indoors poem. There's an old woman in my town who lives with her son, who himself is not that young. You know, he's old enough to have gray hair. And one time a neighbor told me this odd fact about them, that the mother washes the son's hair once a week on wash day. Of course, I had to write a poem about that. But a funny thing happened, you know, when I sat down to write this poem, I wasn't allowed to smirk about these people as the neighbor had done. First of all, because I liked them too much, but also as I began to work on this poem, I came to see them as they really were, as two old Yankees who wouldn't be caught dead touching each other under normal circumstances. Yet they'd invented this weekly ritual that allowed them to do just that. to touch each other. The poem is called Making Things Clean. One would hardly recognize him like this, the high school shop teacher, glasses off, bent over the kitchen sink. Nearby, house dresses and underpants flutter in the window of the Maytag he bought for his mother. Its groaning is the only sound while she washes his hair, lifting the trembling water in her hands, as she has always done, working foam up from his gray locks like the lightest batter she ever made. Soon enough, glasses back on, he will stand before students who mock his dullness. Soon, putting up clothes, she'll feel the ache of a body surrendering to age. A little longer, let him close his eyes against soap by her apron. Let her move her fingers slowly, slowly, in this way the two of them have found to be together. This transfiguring moment in the world's old work of making things clean. I once had a friend, an old man named Brad Newcomb, who in his blindness and in his failing health and failing memory was taken into a nursing home, much to his dismay. And every time I went into that nursing home to visit him, it was such an awful place. I wanted to get him out of it. But, of course, I had no rights in the matter. And so I wrote this poem about it instead, which is called Coming for Brad Newcomb. The childish striped jersey someone has dressed him in, his silly sneakers upturned on the bed, do not anyway matter. We've come to see his old dear head blinking awake, the pupils straying upward, the great brow turning toward us as if listening. We've come to lean close by the bad haircut he cannot see, to tell him who we are. And if this night his lips become a thumb and forefinger, searching for a page, we'll ponder the luck of all his forgetting. We've come to lift him down and place him chest and knuckle bones in his wheelchair and take him high above its spokes, carrying light through the dim hall. And when we pass wheelchairs that bear those others, like shopping carts with lost groceries, we'll wave a wide hello, then wave goodbye to the desk nurse, surprised to see old Bradford, blind and frail, go by, imperial and smiling. For we have come to this closed, loveless, spiritless place to leave it, you opening up the heavy door and I pushing him out into the growing dark, not long, not far, to where the grass smells like Kentucky, where she and he first met. And if then he should call, as he has called each night when nurses come to quiet him, the one name he cannot forget, we'll let Brad Newcomb be there in the half-light, the breeze loosening his hair, blind and awake to the ubiquitous speech of trees. Walt Whitman, the father of all American poets, as you know, wanted us American poets to stand up for the underprivileged. Stand up, he said, for the stupid and the crazy. So I want to read you a poem. I want to read you a poem about so-called retarded children, or mentally handicapped children, or mentally challenged children, or whatever we may be calling them this week or month, we who are in charge of the names. perhaps to make ourselves feel better about them. The thing is, the retarded children don't care what we call them. They're just who they are. And in fact, the retarded children in this poem are doing perfectly well for themselves, even though there are people in the poem who insist they need help. This poem is titled, "The Retarded Children Play Baseball." Never mind the coaches who try to teach them the game, and think of the pleasure of the large-faced boy on second, who raises hand and glove straight up, making the precise shape of a ball, even though the ball's now over the outfield. And think of the left and right fielders going deeper just to watch its roundness materialize out of the sky and drop at their feet. Both teams are so in love with this moment when the bat makes the ball jump or fly that when it happens, everybody shouts. And the girl with slanted eyes on first base leaps off to let the batter by. Forget the coaches shouting back about the way the game is played, and consider the game they're already playing, or playing perhaps elsewhere on some other field, like the shortstop who stands transfixed all through the action, staring at what appears to be nothing. Well, let me change the tone entirely. I often write poems about the popular culture in America, using images from the popular culture to try to get at American values. And the next two or three poems are poems like that, including this first one from Fire, which, being about the popular culture, has Humphrey Bogart in it and Lauren Bacall in it. And this poem is called Smoking. Once, when cigarettes meant pleasure instead of death, before Bogart got lung cancer and Bacall's voice, called Smokey, fell into the gravel of a lower octave, people went to the movies just to watch the two of them smoke. Life was nothing but a job, Bogart's face told us, expressionless except for the recurrent grimace. Then it lit up with a fire he held in his hands and breathed into himself with pure enjoyment until each word he spoke afterward had its own tale of smoke. When he offered a cigarette to Bacall, she looked right at him, took it into her elegant mouth, and inhaled while its smoke curled and tangled with his. After the show, just to let their hearts race and taste what they'd seen for themselves, the audiences felt in purses, shirt pockets, and even inside the sleeves of t-shirts, where packs of cigarettes were folded by a method now largely forgotten. "Got a light?" somebody would say. "Could I bum one of yours?" Never thinking that two of the questions most asked by Americans everywhere would undo themselves and disappear, like the smoke that rose between their two upturned fingers, unwanted in a new nation of smoke-free movie theaters, malls, and restaurants, where politicians in every state take moral positions against cigarettes so they can tax them for their favorite projects. Just 50 years after Bogart and Bacall, smoking is left mostly in the hands of waitresses huddled outside fancy inns, or old clerks on the night shift in mini marts, or hard hats from the road crew on a coffee break around the battered tailgate of a sand truck, all paying on installment with every drag for bridges and schools. Yet who else but these, who understand tomorrow is only more debt, and know better than Bogart that life is work, should be trusted with this pleasure of the tingling breath they take today, these cigarettes they bum and fondle, calling them affectionate names like weeds and cancer sticks, holding smoke and fire between their fingers more casually than Humphrey Bogart, and blowing it into death's eye. The last black and white TV. Were your parents or you yourself among those children who left their primitive games of giant steps and hopscotch to gather like stunned pygmies before cowboys and puppets, moving in the light of the first black and white TVs? Square bulbs so heavy it took two men to deliver them. As night came on in suburban neighborhoods, perhaps like yours, families unfolded the legs of dinner trays, longing to be in the studio audience with the host of the variety show, or in the white kitchen with a mother and her children as the father arrived at the right moment in his dark suit with the knowledge the rest of them craved. It needs more contrast, someone would say, adjusting a knob until the vegetable slicer they saw between programs, or the black and white shoes, or the kitchen range with the illuminated clock in the changing world behind the glass looked real. Then bought the slicer, the shoes, the kitchen range, and even the new TV that their old TV said would make them feel like they were there. This was how the first black and white TVs made their way to the homes of the poor, who loved them best, turning from disappointment all day long to watch people opening the doors of ranges and cars, or men with easygoing smiles give them away on game shows. When they kicked their sets or pounded them, it was mostly because the picture was starting to roll and ruin the happy ending they were so anxious to see. The last black and white TV might have been one of these, its console scarred by fists, flipping scenes of game show contestants and sheriffs bringing justice to Americans long ago in the West, up out of sight again and again. Or it may have been the set that played itself to death above the heads of old folks at the nursing home in the suburbs, grown sick of wonder and desire. Or perhaps it stares by the old color set into the dust of your own attic, among things you once discovered on the screen and would hardly imagine longing for. They are so strange, so useless, and so still. As the disclosures about Enron and WorldCom have shown us all, in case we weren't paying attention, the CEOs of major corporations have been in charge of the country for some time now. They bought off the politicians long since. So we know how the CEOs are doing on Earth. They're doing pretty well. The question this poem poses is, how are the CEOs doing in their afterlife? Where do they go in the first place? And how are they faring there? This poem is titled, An Executive's Afterlife. The others in hell can't believe he's allowed to go free for eternity. Part of their punishment as they sit beside the fire in chains is to watch him pass by. His punishment, after a life of having all the answers, is to have none whatsoever and keep bumping into people who ask him questions. His wife, for instance, here because she never dared ask him any, choosing to die a slow death instead. How are you? Is all she has to say to make him turn, always for the first time, to discover her with no coiffure and ashes on her face. Under his hand, which never leaves his chest. The pain feels like the beginnings of the coronary that killed him. And it only gets worse when he sees the son he bullied, an old man in chains. Unable to leave the comfort of his father's wealth and live his own life, rich or poor, the son now kneels at the flames, trying to get warm with no result forever. He's too intent to ask his question, which the father on his way already knows. Why did you do this? Soon he walks past former doormen, bellhops, and bag ladies who can't wait to ask him the one thing that makes their day, even in hell. Who do you think you are? Nobody's nice, except the stewardess from first class. She likes serving passengers with expensive suits and wristwatches so much, she must seek them out with her eternally nice smile to inquire, "Would you like something to drink?" She has no drinks, of course. This is hell, after all. So he's left to suffer his unquenchable thirst. Not a hurt or absence he feels in the throat, but there under his hand, in his sensitive and innocent heart, which the devil, to give him his due, went nearly to heaven to find. Well, at the center of this new book, Fire, are poems about a family I grew up in. So I want to read you a couple or three poems about parents, beginning with my mother, who happens to be the central figure in the long narrative poem at the end of the book, Fire, the title poem. My mother had, I should tell you, a bit of a rough start in her life, early in her life, and then a rough start in her marriage, too. So as a consequence, I had a bit of a rough ride myself. My mother never spoke about what was going on inside her. You knew she had an inner life, but she never talked about it. The poem is titled, My Mother Falling Asleep. When my mother was 18, she escaped from that tyrant, her mother, and the brothers she had to raise, ending up 5 years later with a husband who'd left her, and my two brothers, and me. Was this when she began to turn against her body, denying it in the end every pleasure? Angry with us, she was angrier at herself, staying up all night long to sew the clothes she took in, her mother on her mind. Sleep was for people who had nothing better to do, she said. Were we on her mind too then and later, the sons she left behind, as her hands became intimate with work in the small light of her machine? Late in her life, when work became her only true friend and she gave up regular meals, she dragged her body, which no longer knew what time it was, to the garden to pick green beans or tomatoes in the middle of the night. Sitting to talk during the day, she clasped her arms together and leaned forward, closing her eyes, until you were looking at the crown of her old, crazed head. I think of my mother falling asleep in those moments, free of the self-destruction and guilts she never spoke about or found the words for. I see her holding her body, or it holding her, bringing her slowly down into its folded arms. Well, eventually my stepfather joined the family. My stepfather, who died a while back, in my childhood was a somewhat remote and mysterious figure to me, and the two of us had a difficult relationship. And this poem about him is called Shovels. Who could have guessed he would choose to spend so much of his time bent over a shovel? One wrist so weak he wore an ace bandage on it, his asthmatic lungs forcing him to stop for breath again and again. "Never mind," he would say to us, his three young stepsons, when we stopped too. "Get back to work." Every weekend for a whole winter, we hauled cinders from the paper mill to level the driveway. That next spring, he had us digging holes for the barn's corner posts, angry that we kept fighting with one another in our anger about the endlessness of banging our shovels into the nearly frozen ground. Why did he drive us that way? Why was he so hard on himself? Always the last one to come in the house out of the dark. One summer, we dug until we found ourselves inside a waist-high trench he said would bring water up from the river to the plants of his nursery. "You'll never get anywhere," he told us, "until you learn the meaning of work." Above ground in the moonlight, as I return through this poem, the tall grass has no idea where we laid that pipe. The sprinkler system for the nursery, dead for years, has forgotten why. All the truckloads of fill we brought to prevent the bank's erosion are on their way down into the river. In the back of the old barn, its aluminum siding curled from the weather, the shovels we once used stand upside down against the wall and the windows light like flowers, making a kind of memorial to the work we did then. Some with blunted points, some scalloped at the center, for after all those years of shoveling, they shovel themselves away. I happen to have a relative who lives in Wisconsin and plays the accordion. And every time he does, he closes his eyes and he sinks down in his chair and he gets so swept away. I began to wonder when I was working on this poem, what would happen if he actually did get swept away? That is, what would happen if while he was pumping this thing, he began to lift up off the floor? Which is what happens in this poem. I had to change a few things to make it happen. I had to give him some cats, which he does not have, and a new wife, a few little changes. But as we know, a poem is not a poem if it's all real life. So this poem is called When Paul Flew Away, and the one who's narrating it is the wife watching this happen. When Paul flew away. It was the same as always, Paul opening the big black lung of it with that worried look while the cats watched from under the stove. But when he closed his eyes and begun to sink down between the straps of his bib overalls, it was like he died. Except the accordion was still breathing, a waltz between his hands. Except he called back to us every so often from wherever he was, "Shit!" Which meant everything he had ever known in his life up to that moment, but this song. Not some sock drawer music of getting a tune out and then rummaging for the chord to match, but together, exactly like he was breathing the thing himself. No stomping either, just Paul twisting like he was after some deep itch, only right then he was starting to lift out of his chair. Slowly at first, like flypaper in a small breeze, then the whole enormous weight of him hanging over the sink. God, he was happy, and I and the kids was laughing and happy, when all at once it come to me, this is it. Paul is leaving. The old Barca lounger stuck in second position, and the TV on top of the TV that don't work, and all my hand paintings of strawberries, as if he never said this would be Strawberry Farm. "Hey," I said, out in the yard, because he was already going right over the roof of the goat shed, pumping that song. "What about you and me?" And Paul just got farther and smaller until he looked like a kid unfolding paper dolls over and over, or like he was clapping slowly at himself. And then, like he was opening up the wings of some wild black bird he had made friends with just before he disappeared into the sky above the clouds over all of Wisconsin. There he goes. I mentioned cats in that last poem. Let me read you a poem exclusively about cats. This is the shortest poem I ever wrote. And I wrote it back in the beginnings of my marriage and my family and so on. We had a couple of cats. Actually, there were large kittens in this moment when both of them at the same time went into heat for the first time. And it was, of course, a miserable moment for all of us, during which they made the sound, which was less like a meow than a man's name. So this poem is titled Calling Harold. Together at the window are two half-grown female kittens, suddenly long-necked and deep-eyed, stare all day, calling, Harold! Harold! Over and over. I told you it was a short poem. So, three more poems. It was a wild period in my family, you know, those years ago. And, you know, I was telling somebody at dinner, my wife brought a couple of children to the marriage, and we quickly had two more. And this poem from Fire is about that period. And it's called The Rules of the New Car. Maybe you parents out there can hear a special resonance in that title, The Rules of the New Car. After I got married and became the stepfather of two children, just before we had two more, I bought it. The bright blue, sorrowful car that slowly turned to scratches and the flat black spots of gum in the seats and stains impossible to remove from the floor mats. Never again, I said, as our kids, four of them by now, climbed into the new car. This time, there will be rules. The first to go was the rule I made for myself about cleaning it once a week. Though why, I shouted at the kids in the rearview mirror, should I have to clean it if they would just remember to fold their hands? 3 years later, it was the same car I had before, except for the dent my wife put in the grill when, ignoring the regulation about snacks, she reached for a bag of chips on her way home from work and hit a tow truck. Oh, the ache I felt for the broken rules and the beautiful car that had been lost and the car that we now had on soft shocks in the driveway, still unpaid for. Then one day, for no particular reason except that the car was loaded down with wood for the fireplace at my in-laws' camp, and groceries, and sheets, and clothes for the week, my wife in the passenger seat, the dog lightly panting beside the kids in the back, all innocent anticipation, waiting for me to join them. I opened the door to my life. So I want to read this next to the last poem for that selfsame woman, my wife, Diane, the one in the car who did that terrible thing to the grill of that car. Because this poem has Diane's mother in it, who was dear to both of us. I should tell you that a few years back, my mother-in-law had a stroke that paralyzed her whole left side. And we didn't know if she'd ever be able to walk again. But gradually, you know, through the miracle of physical therapy, which I'm proud to say I myself helped to apply, she gradually was able to move her left leg and then her left arm after the longest time. And finally, she was able to stand up and walk on her cane. It wasn't a perfect sort of walking, but we wanted to celebrate it anyway. Came along a certain Sunday, and we decided we'd take her out to dinner. So we packed her in the passenger seat in the front there with her cane. I was this two-door sedan, I should tell you. It's important to the story that you remember. It's a two-door sedan. She's in the passenger seat. I'm driving. Diane's in the back. We go to pick up her sister, Dot, a large woman who dearly loved to eat, so we had to take Dot along. We got to the restaurant, pulled into the parking lot, beautiful day, and something disastrous happened. We couldn't get Dot out of the back seat. This is the truth. No matter how much we pushed and prodded and rocked her, she was lodged back there. So I addressed this poem to my wife, Diane, who was even more distressed than I was to see Dot lodged in the back seat that way. And the poem is titled, Happiness. Why, Dot asks, stuck in the back seat of her sister's two-door, her freckled hand feeling the roof for the right spot to pull her wide self up onto her left, the unarthritic ankle. Why does her sister, coaching outside on her cane, have to make her laugh so she flops back just as she was? Though now, looking wistfully out through the restaurant, reflected in her back window, she seems bigger and couldn't possibly mean we should go ahead and without her, she'll be all right. And so, when you finally place the pillow behind her back and lift her right out into the sunshine, all four of us are happy, none more than she, who straightens the blossoms on her blouse, says how nice it is to get out once in a while, and then goes in to eat with the greatest delicacy. Oh, I could never finish all that. And aplomb, the complete roast beef dinner with apple crisp and ice cream, just a small scoop. So that would be Dot. Nope. No. Thank you.
This podcast was brought to you by the Maine Humanities Council, with support from the National Endowment for the Humanities and friends like you. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support.